Hey, you all, it's fundraising time again at the Libertarian Institute. We try not to do this to you too often, but business is business after all. I got a great group of guys and a gal at the Institute, and I gotta pay them. So just go to libertarianinstitute.org/donate to pick your price and help out. We've got some great kickbacks too, books and shirts. Great ones. That's libertarianinstitute.org/donate. And thank you all very much.
Welcome to the Libertarian Institute YouTube and Odyssey channel. Check us out at libertarianinstitute.org. We're going to go through three stories, each of us. Some go back quite a way. Some are about philosophy, history. We try to bring variety at this time. Sheldon Richman is our editor-in-chief at the Libertarian Institute. Sheldon, your first story is the great climate con, Alex Epstein. You're a climate denier? What is going on here?
Well, it's hard to deny. You know, some people say, do you believe in the climate? And the answer is, hell, I've seen it. Believe in it. Hell, I've seen it. There is a climate and there is climate change. So what I'm linking to here is an interview with Epstein. I've talked about a couple of other sessions here because I'm a big fan of his work. Interviewed by Jordan Peterson. Now, I'm not a fan of Jordan Peterson. I agree with him on some things. I disagree with him on a lot of things. But he did a long interview with Epstein, and he basically let him talk. I mean, he can be a little mouthy himself, Peterson, sometimes, but he covered great ground. And one of the points I like, and I think I've stressed this before, but I'll say it again, is that the treatment of the West, the U.S. and Western Europe toward the developing world is really a form of a new colonialism. They're basically saying, if you strip away all the rhetoric, the West is saying, and they do this at these big international conferences, that they're saying to the rulers, not to the people, the rulers of the developing world who would like to be as wealthy as we are. By the way, 2 or 3 billion of them use as much electricity as one of our refrigerators. It gives you an idea of how energy deficient they are. And we've been, so the U.S. is telling the rulers, we'll give you money, not for your people necessarily, you can call it that, but we're giving you money if you'll make sure your people don't have access to fossil fuels, which is what they need and want, because it's cheap and it's reliable and it's like always there, unlike wind and solar, because they want to be as comfortable off as we are. And the Western view is, no, I'm sorry, you can't do that. Yeah, we made it, but you can't do it. You can't do that because that might hurt us. But fossil fuels aren't something that requires reparations for anybody, because fossil fuels have brought longer lives, more plentiful food, lower standards of living, and a drastic reduction just over the last 20 years of absolute poverty to people in the developing world. And what they need, as Alex Epstein points out in his book, Fossil Future, is more fuel. But what they need is freedom. Freedom. If they have freedom, they'll immediately turn to fossil fuels, coal and natural gas and oil, and eventually nuclear. If we ever deregulate nuclear, we'll have more nuclear here. So I recommend this interview if you don't have time to read one of Alex's books, or if you want to supplement it. This is really brings out his views, kind of all aspects of his very pro-human view, which is what's needed in this area.
Connor Freeman, report U.S. mullahs sending small number of troops into Ukraine to track weapons. Fill us in. What's going on here?
Yeah. Excuse me, guys. This is the top story at antiwar.com today. So this is written by Dave DeCamp, and this is all about this piece in NBC News that came out on Monday, where they're talking about how, you know, how there's been more and more agitation, particularly from the Republicans, that we want to have more oversight. We're not just going to give Ukraine a blank check. So what the Pentagon is doing, and apparently the administration, is basically taking, sort of calling their bluff and saying, all right, well, we'll send in more troops to carry out more oversight on these weapons transfers. And so we already have, the Pentagon has officially confirmed that there are U.S. troops in Ukraine conducting what they're calling these on-site weapons inspections. And that's been known since October. And there's, according to this report, a couple of dozen troops there. And they say a small number is involved in tracking weapons. Perhaps there's some others involved in embassy security and God knows what else. But so now they're saying they're going to send, you know, in single digits, but still additional troops to go and do this. The most alarming aspect of this article is the quote in there is that, as Dave points out, the embassy report said that Lloyd Austin, Secretary of Defense, is considering increasing the small troop presence to enhance the oversight mission, but also to ensure there are, quote, experts in the country to help Ukraine use critical weapons systems, signaling that they may be doing more than just tracking weapons. And so, you know, I mean, that is an extreme escalation. We've already had, you know, Sergey Lavrov during the summer wrote up an op-ed, actually, where he was talking about how there were NATO troops aiming the high mobility artillery rocket systems, the HIMARS, when they first, you know, started getting sent into Ukraine by the U.S., and that they were aiming them, of course, at Russian positions. And Ray McGovern wrote up a whole piece about that for antiwar.com. And I mean, it's just incredible that they're actually considering doing this. You know, we already know from previous reportings in the Intercept, especially, that they have and the New York Times, that they have the CIA on the ground, CIA, you know, likely paramilitaries like were there before. But there are CIA, there's a CIA presence and a special operations presence as well. We know we have, you know, special operations forces from NATO countries like Lithuania, Canada, France, and England. And they've been talking about how they're there as a conduit for weapons transfers and providing more intelligence. We've had, you know, reports earlier in the war about these former special operations forces who were there training the Ukrainians very close to the front lines, helping them develop battle plans to use against the Russians. And so we're just getting more and more deeply involved in this war. And, you know, these are just more and more tripwires and increasing the risk. Every single week, it gets worse and worse.
Thomas Sowell wrote a book titled Civil Rights, Rhetoric or Reality. Some very important takeaways. Here's two of them. Much has been made of the fact that the numbers of blacks in high-level occupations increased in the years following passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But the number of blacks in professional, technical, and other high-level occupations more than doubled in the decade preceding the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In other occupations, gains by blacks were greater during the 1940s when there was practically no civil rights legislation than during the 1950s. In various skilled trades, the income of blacks relative to whites more than doubled between 1936 and 1959. The trend was already underway. It may well be that both the economic and legal advances were products of powerful social transformations taking place in the black population and beginning to make themselves felt in the consciousness of whites as well as in the competition of the marketplace. If crime is a product of poverty and discrimination, as they endlessly say, why was there so much less of it when poverty and discrimination were much worse than today? One of the great scams today is that if you don't support a very heavy interventionist state, what you're really saying, this is the entire thesis of Kevin Kraus, the major historian selling this terrible revisionist history, is that what we're really saying is it's code for not caring about the plight of women, not caring about the poor, and not caring about the plight of blacks. Nothing could be further from the truth. We have the moral and empirical evidence to back it up. Check it out, Civil Rights Rhetoric or Reality, Thomas Sowell, 1986. Sheldon Richman. Next story we have is from George Will Hale's Bernstein Books as perhaps the most consequential American book of 2022. What's here?
Well, this is a subject I'm writing about. It will be in my column tomorrow. George Will has had a book review of a new volume by David Bernstein, who's a professor of law at the George Mason University Antonin Scalia Law School, that's called Classified, The Untold Story of Racial Classifications in America. You can also find presentations that Bernstein has made at the Cato Institute and other places on YouTube very easily, and they're well worth listening to. He's very entertaining. Unfortunately, in a horrifying way, it's entertaining. It's the story of how the government came up with racial classifications, which it uses for eligibility for various programs, Small Business Administration loans, affirmative action, all kinds of things, government contracts, you know, set asides, all kinds of preferences. It began in 1978 I think the Office of Management and Budget started it out, and it sounds innocent enough, maybe in intention it was innocent. It was simply to standardize the definitions of Black or African-American, Hispanic and white and other groups, because different federal departments were using different definitions because they weren't standard. So they thought, well, for statistical purposes, let's at least standardize the definitions. But they cautioned that these were not scientific, genetics, anthropological categories. They got some people together and asked, okay, what do you think a Black person is? What do you think a Hispanic is? And then it was totally like that way, informal. And they also said this should never be used regarding eligibility for government programs and stuff. So all that got thrown out, of course. It is used for that, and it became crazy. And he's got great examples of how insane it is. For example, we have a category Asian. One of the things you can check off on your census form, or so many of the form, every form now asks for stuff like this: race, ethnicity, national origin. Asian, of course, is a huge continent and includes all kinds of disparate populations that have basically no relation to each other, and yet they get put into one thing. So somebody from India, an American who hails from India subcontinent or Pakistan, is considered Asian, but so are very sort of distant groups from Japanese, Chinese, Philippines, and others, and they have very little in common, nothing specific in common, and examples like that. I mean, Hispanic is a real grab bag because the Spanish, if you recall, were conquistadors. They came to the New World as conquerors and conquered, so did the Portuguese, Latin America. And yet, why would Hispanics be a protected class? Well, you may say, well, it's the Indians that mixed that ended up mixing with the Spanish, so it's really the Indians. So why don't you call them Indians? Well, that's because the Indian category is reserved for North American Indians north of the Rio Grande, American Indians and Canadian Indians. And once that category was come up with, the recipients didn't want to admit other members to the group because that would spread the benefits too thin. It's a totally insane thing, not to mention that it's extremely dangerous for government to be classifying citizens by group and treating people as members of groups rather than as individuals.
Connor, Washington erases red lines, escalates proxy war with Russia.
Yeah, so this is all about, this is a new column I have out today. It's all about these drone strikes that were carried out last week inside Russia, launched from Ukraine. In one particular instance, there were two drone strikes on two separate airfields that killed a few Russian soldiers and damaged two Russian nuclear-capable strategic bombers. And this attack actually was carried out roughly 300 miles deep inside Russia. And the major concern here, apart from the risks of escalation, and of course there was immediately retaliatory strikes across the country of Ukraine targeting their civilian infrastructure, making life that much worse for these people, the citizens of Ukraine, who are millions of them are left without power, heat, electricity, water, so what's going on basically is it looks like the Americans are now saying that they're going to tacitly endorse, this was in the London Times, I believe, that they are going to tacitly endorse these attacks and perhaps now even consider providing the long-range weaponry, fighter bombers, and rockets that have a much longer range that they previously were reluctant to send over for fear of escalation with Moscow. And here's their reasoning. It's incredibly barbaric and callous, but they go, well, since Russia's revenge attacks have been restricted to, conventional bombing of civilian targets, and he hasn't attacked a NATO member yet or dropped a tactical nuclear weapon, we feel like we can just kind of go ahead now and really escalate in terms of our arms shipments. And basically my argument is what you're doing by this policy is erasing red lines unilaterally so that now you don't know when and where you're crossing them. So what are we doing? Are we, is the plan, is Washington's plan, is Biden's White House's plan to just keep escalating until a NATO member state is attacked and we're in World War III, or until Putin drops nukes, in which case, even if they're restricted to, you know, Ukrainian territory, the pressure of, you know, both foreign and domestic will be insurmountable for the White House to launch a nuclear strike in response. And so we're just put on a much, a very tenuous, this is a very tenuous situation. And so they basically, yeah, the argument is that so long as he doesn't attack a NATO member state or use nukes, we're going to encourage Ukraine to continue attacking more deeply inside Russia. And, you know, the other thing too is they say in that piece that as long as they don't target families or carry out assassinations, that's fine. You know, we're not going to tell them what they can do with the weapons. They're their weapons. And they go, we just want them to follow the international laws of war and the Geneva Conventions. And what's more despicable about that piece is we know from the New York Times, because I had covered this story previously for antiwar.com, and then it got months later, they admitted the New York Times, U.S. intelligence officials said, we believe that Kiev carried out the car bomb assassination that killed the journalist Daria Dugina, which was meant to kill her father, the Russian philosopher Alexander Dugin. And not only that, but there have been attacks on residential areas, villages, you know, oil depots, much closer to the border with Ukraine, the shared border. But still, there have been helicopter and drone attacks going on for months and months inside Russia during this war. And it's only, you know,
I'm really looking forward to see whether or not the Azov battalion passed the background check, because I'm sure they did it before they took they took billions to give them arms. My second one here is on the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Joe Rogan asked for a little clarification on it. Mr. Rogan, Libertarian Institute is at your service. This is an author, John J. Mearsheimer, from Chicago University, very well respected. He summarizes the Gulf of Tonkin lie as follows. The Johnson administration told two lies about what happened in the waters off the coast of North Vietnam. First, the president and his aides purposefully gave the impression that there was no doubt the August 4th incident was an attack that actually took place. Johnson, for example, responded on August 7th to an official protest from the Soviet leader Khrushchev by saying that there was complete and incontrovertible evidence that the North Vietnamese had attacked the Maddox. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara later said the same thing. The second lie concerns the Johnson's administration claim that the Maddox was on a routine patrol in the Gulf of Tonkin and that the alleged attack was, quote, deliberate and unprovoked. In fact, one reason that the Maddox was in those waters was to collect intelligence in support of South Vietnamese forces that were attacking the North Vietnamese coast at the time. And not surprisingly, almost every top-level American policymaker understood that Hanoi would view the Maddox as a party to those attacks. So this is what governments do, intentionally provoke incidents, knowing what's going to happen. So dangerous. We just had Vladimir Zelensky bomb Poland, kill two civilians, try to pin it on Russia, and try to get NATO to declare Article 5. Lloyd Austin said, look, yes, it was Ukraine, but ultimately Russia's still at fault. This is how dangerous it is. That lie led to millions of people dying in Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, 58,000 American servicemen, mass enslavement under the guise of conscription. We must oppose the warfare state at all costs. Check out libertarianinstitute.org. Donate, help us spread this vitally important message. Sheldon Richman, Adam Schiff on Reason Magazine. Ugh, I get a headache just from saying the name. What's up with him?
With the Twitter files being posted on Twitter by journalists Matt Taibbi, Barry Weiss, Michael Schellenberger, the anti-free speech, and I realize Twitter can't violate the Constitution, it's a private company, but they, but the people that just do not like free speech are going crazy and are making all kinds of comments and warning about violence and all that. But it's particularly disturbing when it's somebody from the government. So Jacob Sullum, a very good reporter and syndicated columnist related to linked to Reason Magazine, reports that Adam Schiff, Democrat from California, you might remember him from Russiagate, claimed he had evidence about the collusion between Trump and Russia in the election, which he never was able to produce. Anyway, Schiff is demanding action in response to an unquote unacceptable rise in bigoted slurs on Twitter since Elon Musk took over the platform in late October. Musk responded by taking issue with the evidence that Schiff cited, saying, quote, hate speech impressions are actually down by one third for Twitter now versus prior to acquisition, close quote. What Solomon says, what he should have said is that government officials in a free society have no business demanding the suppression of speech they do not like. And that's exactly what he should have said. When somebody like Schiff talks, Schiff is a legislator. Or if it's somebody from the executive branch, they potentially are regulators. And if they go, as we know, they were constantly pressuring Twitter during the 2020 election to kick people off or bottle up tweets that would have hurt Biden, most famously, of course, the Hunter Biden laptop story. But when government officials do that, it is a constitutional matter. Because they don't need to even wink their eye. We know there's an implicit threat there. And this idea that so-called hateful speech, some of which may be truly hateful, but much of it isn't. You could be accused of hateful speech pre-Musk by saying there are only two sexes and that men can't become women. People lost their accounts because of that. The idea that hateful speech, even real hateful speech, is dangerous because somebody else, not the speaker or the tweeter, but someone else goes out and commits violence. So that means we should be policing what people say because some nut somewhere else may use that as a pretext to commit violence. This is insane. This is the stuff of suppression of speech, and we should not tolerate it.
Connor Freeman, next one we have is U.S. Marines in Ukraine. What's going on here?
Yeah, so our assistant news editor, the great Will Porter, wrote this up on December 14th. And so this is all about how we have so there's Lieutenant General Robert McGowan, who is speaking to the Royal Navy's official magazine, The Globe and Laurel, who is a former head of this elite unit, 45 Commando. Of these special operations for the elite of the British Marines. And he's talking about how they were, previously training troops in Norway in winter warfare, but they'd have participated in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq as well, but that they have been deployed to Ukraine on two separate occasions so far throughout this war. But he's talking about how so they went there to help remove the British embassy staff, the diplomatic staff, just before the Russians invaded. And then they returned back in April, presumably to help them get to the embassy, safely back in April when the Russian forces withdrew from areas around Kiev. Now, what's interesting is McGowan says in April they returned into the country to reestablish the diplomatic mission, providing protection to the critical personnel. During both phases, the commandos supported other discrete operations in a hugely sensitive environment and with a high level of political and military risk. And this dovetails again with what we were what I was discussing previously in the Intercept, where they talk about how the CIA and special operations clandestine missions have expanded greatly since the war began. And that they've sent much more of these forces back in over the course of the war. And of course, we don't know the full extent of what these troops are up to, these special operators and what they're doing. But of course, the Russians have accused British commandos of being involved in the sabotage attack on the Nord Stream pipelines. Kit Clarenberg for the Gray Zone wrote up a piece about their involvement in the truck bombing of the Kerch Bridge, which, of course, is what provoked Russia's massive strategic bombing campaign ever since October. And, of course, one of the more interesting things about the British, as I believe in April, it was shocking when we originally got the report in the Times about how, local Ukrainian commanders were saying that, look, the British SAS troops, they've been here in Kiev. They're teaching us how to fire these new light anti-tank weapons that they're supplying us. And I believe that was the first reporting we had of Western special forces actually being deployed to Ukraine. and it, once the war began. And so, of course, just like in this piece from NBC that I opened my section with, there's a quote in there from a former, I believe, a special operations commander. Regardless, the quote is that this is classic mission creep. And so, of course, this is just more and more tripwires, and we're going to be seeing more and more covert attacks going on now at this point. And of course, we're all implicated because of the way our governments are structured.
A wise man once told me the way to see through future lies is to analyze previous lies. Bill Maher the other day said, look, of course, I'm not saying every Islamist is some sort of suicide terrorist, but I am saying if you are a suicide terrorist, you're probably a Muslim. Can we just agree on that? No, we cannot. This is a book titled The Explosion of Global Suicide Terrorism and How to Stop It, Cutting the Fuse by Robert A. Pape and James K. Feldman. From 1980 to 2003, the connection between suicide terrorism and Islamic fundamentalism is weaker than many might have thought. Although there are prominent Islamic suicide terrorists, most particularly from Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in the West Bank and Gaza, the world leader during this period was not an Islamic group. It was the Hindu, avowedly anti-religious, Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, LTTE, in Sri Lanka, whose 157 suicide terrorists totaled more than Hamas and all other Palestinian suicide groups combined. Of the suicide terrorists associated with Hezbollah in Lebanon during the 1980s, only 21% were Islamic fundamentalists, while 71% were communists and socialists, 8% were Christian. In Turkey, 100% of the PKK suicide attackers were secular. Now, what they do is they always tell you, we're up against a unique kind of evil this time. This is like nothing we've ever seen before, so you can't use failures and past wars to stop us from going in now. These people, they just commit suicide as if kamikaze pilots never existed previously. They're doing the same thing with Russia. Putin is uniquely evil. They're uniquely targeting children. In China, they're uniquely fill in the blank. Same scam, different day. If you appreciate the work we do, please check out libertarianinstitute.org. We have tons of books such as What Social Animals Owe to Each Other, a collection of Sheldon Richman's 50 essays, my book, The Voluntarist Handbook, an introduction to the entire war on terrorism titled Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. We have podcasts from people like myself, Kyle Anzalone, Scott Horton, and Tommy Salmons, along with Patrick McFarlane of the Vital Dissent podcast. Thanks so much for watching the Libertarian Institute YouTube and Odyssey channel. Sheldon and Connor, thank you for your time, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.